Good evening. What's new in the papacy? I was going to begin tonight with the text from the Gospel to reflect on Pope Francis and what's new in the papacy. That text, God have mercy on me, a sinner, because that's been this Pope's most repeated theme since his election, and indeed long before that. God have mercy on me, a sinner. And another line from today's Gospel might be this Pope's motto: all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. A key story in the Pope's life, which is told in the first edition of my book, Untying the Knots, was of how he was a strict authoritarian figure when he was the leader of the Jesuits in Argentina. He said in an interview after he became Pope, "I came across as an ultra-conservative because of my authoritarianism." But then, quite late in life, at the age of 54, he underwent a transformation which turned him into the icon of simplicity and humility that we see today. But humility was not some kind of character trait. It was a technique which he adopted, an audacious or even ostentatious humility, as a way of curbing this proud authoritarianism of his youth. But then I thought, no, this is not a sermon, this is an address, and to learn what's new in the papacy, you only have to turn on the television or look in a newspaper. Because three things have happened this week, three key things which will tell you all you need to know about what's new in the papacy. First, Pope Francis has managed to engineer the first meeting in history between a pope and the Patriarch of Moscow, who's one of the two key figures in the Orthodox Church, which split from Rome almost 1,000 years ago. And that meeting is one which has eluded his predecessors for decades and even centuries. The second event this week is that one of the world's most audacious and outspoken campaigners against sex abuse was this week sacked from Pope Francis's Commission for the Protection of Children and Vulnerable Adults within the Church. And the third thing is his visit to Mexico, where this Pope, this first Pope from the Global South, is, even as we are here this evening, continuing his particular ministry to the world's poor, oppressed, and marginalized. So I'll begin in Havana on Friday, when Pope Francis met Patriarch Kirill of Moscow and greeted him with the word, after 1,000 years, "Finally." It was characteristic of the directness and the humour and the informality of Francis. The two men signed a joint declaration which wasn't deep but was extraordinarily broad. It dealt with the world, with society and the church. On the world, it focused on the persecution of Christians in the Middle East and North Africa, terrorism, the war in Syria, and the plight of refugees and migrants. On society, it confirmed the common position of both churches on consumerism, religious freedom, aggressive secularism, the family, marriage as between a man and a woman, abortion, euthanasia, and the ethical dilemmas raised by biotechnology. And on the church, it declared a common commitment on unity, interreligious dialogue, and eliminating the tensions between the Greek Catholics and the Greek and Russian Orthodox, particularly in Ukraine. And afterwards, Pope Francis said, "We spoke like brothers." But for all the warmth and directness and simplicity of Francis, he is no holy fool. He is a sophisticated and shrewd political operator. And to understand how that works and how this meeting between Pope and Patriarch came about, you need to cast your mind back to the moment that Francis was elected on the 13th of March in 2013, and the man who was known and born Jorge Mario Bergoglio stepped out onto the balcony in St. Peter's Square, having been elected and having been the first pope ever to dare to take the name Francis, the name of the great saint of the poor. And the new pope stood there with his arms straight by his sides and made a very simple blessing with his right hand towards the crowds in the piazza below. And he was in plain white. He wasn't in the scarlet and ermine cape, which is the symbol of pontifical authority. Plain white, and on his chest a plain old metal cross where his predecessors had worn bejeweled gold. So everything the man did right from the outset, this first pope from the developing world, was deeply understated. And he didn't call himself pope, he called himself Bishop of Rome. And then came this, he said, "Now, let's begin this journey, bishop and people, this journey of the Church of Rome, which is the one that presides in charity over all the churches, a journey of brotherhood, love, trust among us." So let me repeat the key part of that. The Church of Rome, which is the one that presides in charity over all the churches. Only church scholars listening realized how important that phrase was, presides in charity. It was a quotation from the first century Saint Ignatius of Antioch, a saint from before the split between the Catholics and the Orthodox. And decoded, this amounted to a call to restore collegiality inside the church and between the churches. Francis was, in lay terms, declaring the Pope not to be the boss, but rather to be first among equals. The patriarch of the Greek Orthodox Church, Bartholomew in Constantinople, immediately saw what this meant. And he became the first head of the Orthodox Church to accept an invitation to attend a papal installation, the first one since that great schism in 1054. Now, tradition has it that when the Pope steps onto the balcony, the new Pope, he offers a blessing, urbi et orbi, to the city and the world. But before he did that, this Pope broke with tradition and said before he blessed the people, they should pray for him first. And he bowed his head before the crowd to receive their prayer. It was a gesture of personal humility, but it was also a gesture of institutional humility. The great schism had come about because a pope had insisted to patriarchs that he was their superior, they must defer to Rome, and now almost a whole millennium later, here was a pope saying something different. And that is how, on Friday in Havana, Kirill, the patriarch of Moscow, became the first Russian Orthodox primate to meet a pope. But it's important to understand that there's more to this than theology or ecclesiology. Francis is a pope who works subtly on many levels at once. And he knew that Kirill is much closer to the Kremlin than previous patriarchs. It's said that the Russian primate was once a covert KGB agent. And he would have been unlikely to agree to a meeting with the pope without the tacit approval of Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. Francis had sent out signals, warm signals, to Putin, inviting him to the Vatican not long after he was elected Pope, and then again in June last year. Putin likes to style himself a defender of Christianity. He's even presented his bombing campaign in Syria as, among other things, a defense of Syrian Christians. For Putin, Orthodox Christianity is a useful buttress to his ultra-nationalistic vision of Russian identity. And Putin, who feels diplomatically isolated internationally, needs some kind of foreign policy success and saw a rapprochement between Catholics and the Orthodox as politically useful. Now, Pope Francis is no fool. He was aware of what Putin was doing and what the mixed motives were of the Russian Patriarch. The Russian Patriarch also wanted to make sure that the Patriarch in Constantinople wasn't stealing a march on him as a friend of the Pope. But the Pope saw mutual advantage in this idea of defending the Christians in the region, where, in the words of the joint declaration which Francis and Kirill signed on Friday, whole families, villages and cities of our brothers and sisters in Christ are being completely exterminated, their churches barbarously ravaged and looted, their sacred objects profaned, their monuments destroyed. So what we see in Friday's events is the way that Francis operates on many levels at once, on a theological level, a pastoral level, and a political level. Cuba was settled on as the place where the two would meet, in part because Francis had had a personal role in restoring relations between the United States and Cuba. Francis had taken part in this last thawing of the Cold War. And after that event, the Pope had talked about piccolo passi, which is Italian for baby steps. That is how progress must be made in these matters, carefully and often laboriously. And we saw another good example of this after his visit to the Holy Land, when he invited the presidents of Israel and Palestine to a summit, a prayer summit, in the Vatican. Political commentators afterwards were very swift to denounce that it had been a failure, nothing had come of it. But that is not how progress is made in Francis's book. When he made overtures to the Jewish and Muslim community in Argentina long before he was Pope, he did it by inviting their leaders to his flat for a cup of coffee where they talked about football. So piccolo passi, that's the thing to watch out for with Francis, and who knows what kind of fruit the meeting between Pope and Patriarch might bring on Christian unity or on geopolitics eventually. There is much that I could talk about tonight when under the title of What's New. The first edition of my book is now out of print. The second one, which is over there, has got 9 extra chapters. That's how much this Pope has done in the past 2 years. And they range across, the chapters range across the whole variety of activities of the Pope. So they examine his powerful teachings on mercy and compassion, which I'll come to in a moment. His insistence on putting people before dogma. There's a chapter on his words and actions on the global economy's disregard for the poor and for the planet. And one on his far-reaching reforms in the Vatican Bank, which is the most successful area of his reforms. He's closed 3,000 of the bank's 19,000 accounts, and he's ruthlessly swept aside all individuals that he saw as obstacles to change. There's a chapter on his reform of the Vatican bureaucracy, a harder task, but one on which he's making real progress. He's set up an inner circle of cardinal advisers from all around the world, tough men who have been previous critics of the Vatican and who are contributing to this new style of leadership of Francis and making room for new voices. And the 39 new cardinals that Francis has appointed are almost exclusively from poor countries, a few from Europe, none from the United States, and now almost half of the body which will elect the next pope comes from the poor world. So he is making significant changes there. There are areas of lesser progress. He is very ambivalent in his attitude to the place of women in the church. He proclaims often that the church needs a new theology of women, but then when he appointed just 5 women to the 30-strong International Theological Commission, he welcomed them and described them as the strawberries on the cake. And one woman theologian said, if we're the strawberries, the men are the nuts. And at the heart of that second edition of the book is an account of how battle lines are being drawn within the Catholic Church between Francis and ideological conservatives in what I call a struggle for the soul of Catholicism. And there are behind-the-scenes stories of all of these topics in the book, and they cast light on a man who is essentially a pope of paradoxes. I can't go into that tonight. I haven't got the time, but I'm going to just choose one example, and it's one which has been in the news this week from those areas, and it is sex abuse. And this is an area in which Francis appears to be faltering. The sex abuse crisis has deeply shamed the Catholic Church in the closing decades of the last century and been a real crisis to its moral authority. And what the book exposes is why that progress has been so slow and so patchy. And it is because there is a kind of hidden civil war inside the Vatican over sex abuse. On one side are the reformers who want public accountability for paedophile priests and the bishops who oversee them. And on the other side are the members of the Roman old guard whose instinct for cover-up continues. And this second group is surreptitiously doing everything it can to undermine the Pope's reform agenda. And this opposition is at some of the very highest levels in the Vatican. So I'll tell you the story of this as an example of what's not new in the Vatican. 2 years ago, Francis set up a body to advise him on this, which is called the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. And it's made up of clerics, theologians, but lay people too, psychiatrists, therapists, and most significantly, two people who are survivors of clerical sex abuse, a man and a woman. The man, who's perhaps the most vocal of them all, is Peter Saunders. He founded something in the UK called the National Association for People Abused in Childhood. And he's one of the most vocal and forthright campaigners on this. And when Francis chose him to join the papal panel, it seemed that real change was in the air in Rome. But that was 2 years ago. And this week, Saunders was sacked in a signal that behind the scenes, the old guard are in the ascendancy in some areas and that the Catholic Church is reverting to bad old habits. To see how this is operating, if you go back to the first meeting of that commission, which is in May 2014, the commission's president was Cardinal Sean O'Malley, the Archbishop of Boston, and he'd been given this job because he was the person who cleared up the sex abuse scandal in Boston. The previous cardinal was sacked or retired to Rome and promoted, as is the way in Catholicism. And if any of you have seen the film Spotlight, it deals with this issue of how sex abuse in Boston was revealed to be systemic. And it was one of the first examples of the scale of the problem confronting the church. So at this first meeting of the commission, Cardinal O'Malley startled the other members of the commission by revealing that establishing this group had run into more internal opposition inside the Vatican than any of the Pope's other reforms apart from overhauling the Vatican finances. The opponents of the commission argue that a public body like that will only further damage the church's reputation. Washing dirty linen in public is not a good idea. Others argued, rather bizarrely, that this wasn't a universal problem, it was an Irish problem, and you only found sex abuse in countries where Irish priests had emigrated to, like England, the United States and Australia. Reports flooding into commission members now show how ludicrous this idea is, because they come from all over the world. And other opponents have dismissed sex abuse as a historical problem and said, now there are better controls for the selection of candidates for the priesthood, the problem won't recur. But the problem is recurring even as we speak. There were two priests at the meeting of the commission last week that it heard of two priests who'd reported sex abuse by a third priest to their bishop and had been told to keep quiet and say nothing. And when they went to the police and ignored the bishop, they got themselves into extremely hot water. Over the last 2 years, the Anti-Abuse Commission has seen attempt after attempt by people inside the Vatican to undermine it. Key Vatican departments have vied to take control of the body. Its decision to set up offices outside the Vatican was countermanded. Bureaucrats tried to subvert its attempts to write its own statutes, and lay members of the commission staged a revolt. But one of them said to me afterwards, there's an influential camp who are doing their best to block change on this and on a range of other issues on which Francis wants movement, and some of these people have absolutely no scruples about getting their way. The commission was starved of finance. Its press releases were doctored and diluted, and the most recent example of that was just last week when Saunders was asked by the fellow commissioners to take some time to consider whether his outspoken public pronouncements were compatible with his role as a papal advisor, and before he had a chance to do that, press release had gone out to say he'd been sacked. So, the question is, why has Pope Francis been such an effective changemaker in some areas, and yet failed to bring about change in other areas like this one? This particular area, several of those close to Francis have told me, is the problem is that although Francis has a detestation of abuse, he's also very wary of false accusations being made against priests. And that explains why it took him over 2 years to sack a bishop in America called Robert Finn in Kansas City. Finn had actually been convicted in a court in 2012 in the US he was found guilty of failing to report a paedophile priest to the police. And commission members called for Finn to be removed at every one of their meetings, but it took almost 3 years after Finn's criminal conviction for Francis to authorise action. And then, even more controversially, Pope Francis promoted a bishop in Chile called Juan Barros, who had been enmeshed in a cover-up scandal. The Pope met Barros privately, and Barros insisted he was guiltless, and the Pope accepted his assurances and made him a bishop. Now, that all sits uneasily with the policy of zero tolerance that Francis announced in 2014, after the Commission had repeatedly pressed him to endorse that approach. The Commission also repeatedly expressed anxieties about Barros, and the head of the Commission reported them to the Pope, but the Pope did not change his mind, and the installation of the bishop went ahead. The disquiet was such in Chile that installation was actually violently disrupted by protesters. And trust in the Catholic hierarchy in Chile has fallen now from 98% to 25%. Saunders was very critical of the Pope's refusal to ask Barros to stand down, and that's in part why he's been asked to leave or been sacked. So the decision to close ranks in this way looks like, to many outsiders, a return to the Church's instinct to put the protection of the institution above the protection of individuals or the pastoral care of victims. Now, the irony is in all of this that Francis has sought to send out the opposite message in every other respect of his activities. People come before the institution. He is the first pope from the developed world, and he is just this weekend in Mexico about the business we've come to expect of him, visiting prisoners, migrants, indigenous people, the families of victims of violence, of drug traffickers. And on Wednesday, the trip will end on the border of Mexico and southern Texas, where the Pope will say Mass to a congregation which will be divided by the border fence. The Americans and the Mexicans will come together for Mass, but will be divided symbolically by this and practically by this border fence. So we have these three elements: his work in Moscow and the work with the Sex Abuse Commission and the work which we know most publicly about, and that's why I've been briefest about it, about ministering to the poor through the Third World, as we used to call it. And I want to conclude by bringing all this together with a reflection on the Gospel reading that we had, because if there is one word that has characterised the ministry of Pope Francis, it is that word mercy. It's been the repeated theme of his preaching as Pope and before that as Archbishop. And the motto we chose when he became a bishop was Miserando Atque Eligendo, which translates loosely as chosen through the eyes of mercy. Anyone who's heard me speak before will be familiar with the story, which I'm not going to tell at length, but I'll give you a very brief recap of it, that Francis made, by his own admission, hundreds of errors. That was his phrase when he was in charge of the Jesuits in Argentina. And he was so divisive that eventually his order sent him off into exile in the far-off regional city of Córdoba in Argentina. But one of Francis's great characteristics is that he's a man who has learned from his mistakes. He changed after Cordoba, and then from this authoritarian figure into this more listening and consultative figure. And then he changed again when he lived with the poor in the shantytowns of Buenos Aires, where he learned something about the messy realities of the lives of ordinary people. He learned that prostitutes and drug dealers were not just criminals, they were also victims, and there was a complexity to how they needed to be ministered to. He changed his economic and political views when, as Archbishop, he lived through the terrible economic crisis in Argentina in 2001. It had the biggest debt default in world history, and half the population was plunged below the poverty level. And Bergoglio began then to speak like a liberation theologian, which is a development that's continued in his various doctrines and encyclicals as Pope. And finally, the man who was so dour and dutiful as a cardinal, so much so that he was known in Buenos Aires as Horseface, has blossomed into this warm and smiling Pope. And in learning lessons through these situations he's been put in, he has felt himself to have been smiled upon and forgiven by a merciful God. Just before he left for Rome from Buenos Aires and the conclave which elected him Pope, he wrote what turned out to be his last Lenten message to the people of Buenos Aires. And in it he said, "Morality is not never falling down, but always getting up again. And that is a response to God's mercy." At the Angelus message after his election, the first of those messages, he told the crowds in St. Peter's Square, quote, "The word mercy changes everything. It is the best thing that we can hear. It changes the world. A bit of mercy makes the world less cold and more just." And he continued, "The story of the adulterous woman, whom Jesus saves from being condemned to death, captures Jesus' attitude. We do not hear words of contempt. We do not hear words of condemnation, only words of love and mercy that invite us to conversion. Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." God's face is that of a merciful father who's always patient. And in his very first homily as Pope, he said the same thing. "In my opinion, the strongest message of the Lord is mercy." And in Brazil, at the World Youth Day, he said, "I believe this is a time of kairos, of mercy." Kairos, the Greek term for a privileged moment in God's plan for salvation. And last year in his Lenten message, again, "How greatly I desire that all those places where the church is present, especially in our parishes and communities, may become islands of mercy in the midst of a sea of indifference." And you may know he has declared this year an extraordinary jubilee of mercy. Mercy is the force that reawakens us to new life and instills in us the courage to look forward to the future with hope. So what we see in Pope Francis is a holy man, a man who puts the pastoral care of people before the upholding of dogma, a man who is in some ways still wedded to the faults and failings of the Catholic Church, and a man who sees mercy as the solution to that. And my intuition is that the Pope's stress on mercy is not abstract or theological. It is, having talked to dozens of people in Buenos Aires, including people, he still rings there every week. His emphasis on mercy is autobiographical. When a man's elected Pope, he's asked if he accepts the job. And the normal response in Latin is, "Accepto," I accept. But Bergoglio replied, "I'm a great sinner, trusting in the mercy and patience of God in suffering, I accept." So the story of Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis, is the story of a man who sinned and who changed profoundly, radically, and now he's come to a church which has sinned, and he's doing his best to change that too. What's new in the Vatican? A lot, though not perhaps as much as there ought to be. Thank you.